I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. For the rest of this hour, what can theater teach you about leadership and business? Why you should forget everything you've been taught about public speaking, and so much more. Karen Huff is the founder and CEO of Improv Edge, a former actress, motivational speaker, and this year's keynote speaker for the Lawrence Schools Foundation. She's taken her acting skills to coach others to go out on a limb and take risks in the workplace. Karen, thank you for coming in today.
It's my pleasure.
Tell me a little bit about the journey from actor to businesswoman.
Sure. It was a journey that I didn't see coming. You can't plan this kind of thing, obviously, Kay. But I started acting when I was 5. I was on stage then. So I started very young. I loved it. But I didn't learn how to do improv until I went to Yale. So it was as an undergrad at Yale that I learned about improv comedy. And back then, it was not as well known now as it is currently. And so it was a very new form of theater. And a friend of mine from Chicago had learned it and taught it all to us. So we founded the Purple Crayon of Yale, which was the first improv group there. And then we helped other Ivy Leagues to found their first improv group. So it changed my life. It changed the way I thought about theater. It changed the way I thought about performance. And so when I graduated, I wanted to really dive deep. And so I trained and performed with the Second City in Chicago, which was a huge honor. But I also went on to found my own improv groups. And I did everything from film and TV and radio to Shakespeare to Black Box to lots and lots and lots of late night improv. So I had a super career. I was very lucky. I loved every minute of it. And there is a point, I think, for certain kinds of people where you need something new. You've got to take on the next challenge. So I had married and moved to New York, and I never got to see my husband because he was a banker and I was an actor. So one day I literally thought, gosh, technology is really going so quickly. This could be a fantastic place for me. And I got a job in IT. with like no education and no experience whatsoever in it, but a lot of desire and a lot of transferable skills. And so I ended up spending about the next 8 years in network engineering specifically. So that was fantastic. I was able to take one small company that I worked with, went public. I got to watch that happen and be a part of it. I got to be involved in one that was acquired. And I loved business. And I realized that I was doing extremely well. I was certainly cramming and taking classes every single night during that time to bring myself up to speed technically, but I was also improvising during the day. So I could collaborate with my team members. I could help clients understand what we were talking about by simplifying ideas. I could think on my feet. I could come up with good new creative ideas and innovative ideas. And so these are all what improvisers do well. These are all the skills of improv. And so my dear friend was getting her degree at Wharton. And I said,
School
you know,
of business at yeah, the University
Wharton
of
School of Business, right? University of Pennsylvania, exactly. And I said, you know, we should test this idea because I think it's got legs with it. And Wharton allowed us to test with their MBA students. And so my passion and my career since then, over 17 years now, has been the study of isolating the behaviors from the improv stage and proving that they affect high-performing corporate leaders and teams, which they do, and then also finding the science behind it. So I've had the good fortune to work with psychologists, neuroscientists, and their fascination with this behavioral template has been fantastic, and they've really helped me to build up the science side of the work that we do with corporations all over the world.
Let's step back from the academic side. Mm-hmm. Tell me, how is it that people, whether you're operating at the highest level of a corporation or a small business person or just a regular employee, how can they use what you bring to change the workplace?
You know, I think we get really locked up. There's a lot of risk aversion out there. There's a lot of hierarchy out there. But the truth of the matter is that the world is changing very, very quickly. And so if we're going to be able to be as innovative as we have to be and move at the speed that corporations are now and small businesses are, we've got to be extremely flexible. And improvisers step on stage with no script, no props, no costumes. All they have are their team members. Sometimes you lead, sometimes you stand back. You have to be able to change on a dime. You have to see possibility immediately. If something goes terribly wrong on stage, you've got to deal with it and then move on. And these are all the skills that real professionals need today. I mean, wouldn't you agree? It's this is kind of where it's coming from. And you know, when we get down to some of the principles of improv, like yes and, a lot of people have heard of that now. I remember when I first started, nobody heard of yes and. But it's the concept of first agreeing with someone else and then building on their idea rather than yours. And there's a whole lot of no but out there where people go, no, I don't like your idea, but you should listen to mine. Whereas true collaboration and high-performing teams come from, number one, saying yes, I hear you. You're valid. Your idea is valid. Now, we may not end up following it through, but to create a highly collaborative team, everybody's got to have a stake in it and feel like they're heard. And I'm willing to build on it and support you. And those soft skills are the skills of extremely high-performing companies and teams that we see now. And I will tell you, too, that people say, well, what level do you work with? And the funny part is I work with brand new hires. People even in college or just out of college that are just starting their career. And I work with CEOs of multinational corporations and their direct reports because depending on what kind of problems you're trying to solve, these skills are transferable. We work in industries from law, and we work in accounting, we work in science, we work in pharmaceutical and healthcare. My gosh, we work in finance, we work in manufacturing. It's very transferable. It's just a matter of how you apply it to make it successful.
Karen, I know one of the things that you often talk about are women in the workplace. Do you think some of those improv skills, do they vary depending on gender?
They do, actually, believe it or not. There's a whole body of work that I put together on the differences that women have to take into account in order to be successful. So, you know, all of my research has always started from the place of wanting to find out the most information I could to create a learning template for a corporation. So, for example, take negotiation. I started my research in negotiation over 9 years ago and looked at all the negotiation material we could. We held focus groups. We were creating negotiation specifically at that point for attorneys because the Bar Association had come to us and said, hey, we have got all these courses for, you know, what list to prepare and what to do in a negotiation, but we can't handle the emotional side. And somebody gets backed into a corner and starts to sweat and we don't have anything for that. And you seem to have a specialty, and they were right. But during that time, I realized that there was so much gender-specific information that I was finding that we were able to pull that out and create not only a general negotiation course that would work for anyone, but also a course very specific to women. Because as you look across statistics, there are significant differences there. And then as we look at things like presence and how we're perceived in the workplace, I found significant statistical differences for women versus men that if we don't take into account, we could stumble and fall into all sorts of pitfalls.
Karen, just this past week, there was a really interesting story that I'm sure you read about how women in the Obama administration, how they made sure their voices were heard at various staff meetings by, I'm trying to remember, amplification. Was the term.
Yeah.
I'd never heard it before. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's interesting. And I have quite a number of examples from my own clients of the opposite occurring and needing to, I've actually was brought in to coach a male leader who, by the way, the work we do is never men versus women. I think men are a huge support to women. We have a lot to learn from them and vice versa. You know, we want them to lean on us when they need us as well. So what has happened, and again, you can trace this, it's very well documented, that what can happen is a person who is a minority in a conversation will put out an idea. So that woman could be the minority, it could be a racial minority, it could be a religious minority. But when you are sort of alone in a group and the rest of the group is different, they somewhat hear your idea, but they don't really attribute you with the idea. And what often happens is then someone else who is part of that group, so let's just say it's a room full of men and one woman, and I've been in that situation many times. I can see you nodding. You know, a lot of us have been there. And it's not that they mean it maliciously, but, you know, a good idea gets floated. It happens to come from the woman. Another man will repeat it differently a few minutes later, and then suddenly the leader recognizes it.
Perhaps more authoritatively.
True. Maybe said more authoritatively, maybe with different words that were more understandable to the leader. And so that is a common and well-documented issue that occurs, that women's ideas are not heard. They're simply what we call taken and then reimagined. So what happened is it's also pretty well documented that a minority's words are not heard if there is only one of them in the room. So once the Obama administration, the women would be at the table, they would realize that this was occurring. And again, not maliciously, but for some reason or other, the communication wasn't occurring properly. So what they did is, if a woman floated an idea and she was cut off or someone didn't acknowledge it, another woman across the table would immediately repeat it, and not in an in-your-face kind of a way, but they might say, yeah, okay, you know, I like that point that you said about the fact that Lawrence is a great place to grow up. And Susan, you know, have you ever visited Lawrence? Is it a good place to grow up? And then we would have her say it again so that there were multiple voices tracing it back to its source and reminding the people in the room that this is an idea that's out there and we need to hear it. So it's very, very effective. It's not in your face, but it is important, even in places like the Obama administration, which I feel has been tried to be as open and as receiving and as moving forward as they possibly can from a social science standpoint or a behavioral standpoint. We all fall into those situations. I know that I am always constantly trying to be more inclusive. I stumble over my words and I make mistakes and offend other people from time to time. Yet often, the key is to say, wow, I messed up. Help me understand what I can do better next time, and help me recognize that as a better way to move forward.
Karen, you've written a number of articles and a couple of books, including, this is the best title ever, Be the Best Bad Presenter Ever, Break the Rules, Make Mistakes, and Win Them Over. Why would anybody want to be a bad presenter?
Yeah, so that was a really fun title to come up with. And we do surveys every time we put out a new book. And by the way, I'm working on my third right now. So in 17, you'll be able to see one on innovation. So I'm looking forward to that. But Be the Best Bad Presenter Ever came about because a lot of people would come to work with us, with my ensemble and me, and we're in five cities now, so I have the most amazing people that I get to work with. And I kept hearing stories coming in from the field and also from my own experience of people saying they were really bad. They'd walk in and go, look, I'm a really bad presenter. I'm terrible. So you're going to be in pain. And the thing is that they weren't really bad. They were following rules that were making them bad. So the entire book is about breaking all these rules that we think are dyed-in-the-wool, good presentation skills rules, which are really horrible and standing in our way.
Can you give me an example?
Yeah, practice in front of a mirror.
That's good advice or bad advice?
That's bad advice.
Why
is that? Terrible, terrible rule. How many hundreds of times have you been told to practice in front of a mirror?
Lots. And I have to admit, I've never practiced in front of a mirror, but I have practiced in a room by myself.
That's the way to do it.
Okay, yeah. That makes me feel better. But what is it about looking in a mirror that you think it's a good idea, but it's not?
So one of the biggest problems in being a presenter is that you're self-conscious. And if you practice in front of a mirror, it's going to amplify your being self-conscious. You're going to think about how you look. You're going to watch yourself. Not to mention that you practice your speech while you're looking at yourself, and you're becoming obsessed with that thing you do with your mouth or, you know, watching yourself present. And then the first time that you have to, and also you only practice throwing your voice and your energy about 12 inches away, depending on where the mirror is. So then the first time you stand up in front of a crowd, you can't look at yourself, and all you can think about is, I wonder if I'm doing that thing with my mouth. And do I look the way I did? And, oh my gosh, they're saying they can't hear me in the back, but I'm speaking as loudly as I was in front of the mirror. Just all this dumb stuff. Because the key to being a really great presenter, I think, is to focus on the audience, not on yourself. You've got to get out of your head. You've got to watch them, interact with them, talk to them, see if it's landing, engage them, have them do a raise of hands. There's many, many things you can do to get the audience more involved with you and vice versa.
One of the lessons that I've always heard was, if you're uncomfortable establishing eye contact with people in the audience, that you should look over their heads to some undefined place against the back wall. I've also heard that that's really transparent.
It's so bad. It's actually in the book. Yeah, it's really transparent. Anyone I've talked to, when I've said, could you tell that they were looking at the back wall? Every person in the audience would go, oh, yeah, they're staring at the back wall. I can tell. You can tell. So it doesn't work, number one. And it also disconnects you from the audience. Now, I understand that making eye contact can make you very nervous. So what you want to do is give yourself small goals. Or plant somebody. I've had them sit, take a friend. You know, you don't want to give your whole presentation to that friend, but it's nice to have a safe place in the audience to look. So the interesting part about eye contact is that when you make warm and meaningful eye contact with one person, the entire audience feels it. They actually think they're getting it too. So if you're looking at the back wall the whole time, you're basically chilling out the entire audience. So look at your friend for a couple of sentences, and if you need to look away or look at the back, that's okay for a couple sentences, but then come back and look at somebody in the front row for a couple of sentences, and then look up, give yourself a break, take a breath, look at somebody in the fourth row for a couple of sentences, and move it around and practice how to do that. But again, if you're practicing in front of a mirror, you can't do that. It's easier to stand in an empty room or have a friend come and watch you practice. The key is to practice out loud and on your feet and practice that eye contact.
One of the things that I've learned over the course of my career is that everybody needs to do a certain amount of public speaking, and that to say, like, well, that's just not my thing, gets you nowhere in the world. Whether you're working at, you know, whether you're an auto mechanic, you still need to speak to people. Whether you're a radio producer, you need to speak to people, regardless of what you do. Whether you're, you know, flipping burgers at the local fast food place, you're still connecting with people. Are there any jobs where public speaking is not a really good skill to have?
No. Of course, I'm going to be very opinionated about this, but I also think public speaking is having the ability to impact someone with communication. And the point is that even if it's one-on-one, like you made the example of the mechanic, first of all, you want to make that person feel safe, that you're going to do a good job. You may need to sell them the service. And those require a lot of the same skills that public speakers use, of persuasion, of having a really great opening line, of using eye contact with them, of showing them that you're credible, of telling a story, for example. All these skills translate to smaller situations. Now, you're not standing and throwing your arms out and using a loud voice, but you're connecting with that person. And public speaking is speaking one-on-one as well. All the skills that we talk about, you just bring them down and they're translatable to small group meetings, one-on-ones, anything. And, you know, we all want to make our best impression at some point or other. We always want to put our best foot forward. So even a conversation with someone that might be important, if you practice it first, or you think about how I could use a story, or you think about the last thing you're going to say to them before you walk out the door that they should remember, very critical.
As I mentioned, you've written several books, Be the Best Bad Presenter Ever, The Improvisational Edge. You've also written something called the Yes Deck.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
Oh, it was one of the first things that I produced. It's really fun. I wanted to share some of our best ideas. This was early in the career of Improv Edge, which is my company. And I wanted to share some of our best ideas in a playful way, in a simple way. And so we created a deck of cards. So instead of having the four suits of, you know, diamonds and spades, et cetera, we had the four principles of improvisation that we trademarked with the help of Wharton Business School. So there is a yes space suit, a building blocks suit, a team equity suit, and an oops to eureka suit. And so each of those principles, what the deck does is it, first of all, teaches people what those principles mean. It gives them a few cards that have very inspirational quotes on them that have meant a lot to me in my life. And then they also have really cool exercises. So literally anything from, if you're a trainer at a company and you need a great icebreaker, it's in there. If you are someone who has to run a conference call every other week or something, there's great ideas in there about running a good conference call. There's ideas in there about getting out of writer's block or just getting out of your head and being more creative. So it's a really fun tool that you can use to be more engaged and use with your team and learn about improv.
Karen, clearly you've taken all of these theater skills and improv skills and applied them really successfully to the business world. I'm curious if it works the other way. Are there things that you've learned in the business world that translate into the creative side of your life?
Yes, very much so. I think I did have a fairly good business head as an actor, which is part of why I did so well. But, you know, business can teach you a lot about being organized and about role clarity. So you will never meet an actor that won't tell you they can't do everything. And I certainly believe that. You know, you need a great stage manager? Fantastic. You got me. You need a lead? I'm here. You need somebody to sing? done, right? I loved being everything, and you really stretch yourself, which is great. However, there is a point where you need to realize that there are other people who are so much better at you at another skill that you need to make that team work. And that was what improv taught me as well. I had to learn that actually I am the straight. In my improv troupe, they almost always made me the straight because I was never as funny as the other people on stage. But if you don't have the straight or the character person, which is what I always was, you don't have as rich a scenes. So I had my place and I brought my skill. So as a business person, I really have learned that I've got to bring in the right talent to make my business do well and grow. I mean, my project managers have skills I will never, ever have. I have the most fantastic accounting and financial specialists who work with me. I have amazing designers. And, you know, even on the artistic side, we're always pushing ourselves. We're bringing people in who have incredible capabilities and also connections to other industries where I may not have worked. So we have an incredible practice now in architecture because we are working with a person who's not only an architect, but also artistic.
Karen, if you could leave our listeners with sort of one message about public speaking or about applying creativity in a different way to the workplace, what would that message be?
It's to do it. It's to get up and do it. And yes, you will make a mistake and fall flat on your face and it won't go so well. So do it in a safe place. If you want to be a great public speaker, if you want to expand your role at work, if you want to try a different kind of project, you've got to stand up and take that moment of great butterflies in your stomach and step forward and realize that, number one, you'll be given credit for your courage. Number two, improv is about doing. It's not about standing around and thinking about it all the time. And number three, it's about just keeping trying, because I made so many mistakes. I landed flat on my face so many times, but I just kept getting back up again. And again, improv is about doing, so go do it.
Karen, thank you so much for sharing your message.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Karen Huff is the founder and CEO of Improv Edge, a former actress and Lawrence native. She's the author of Be the Best Bad Presenter Ever, Break the Rules, Make Mistakes, and Win Them Over, and The Improvisational Edge, Secrets to Building Trust and Radical Collaboration at Work. She was this year's keynote speaker for the Lawrence Schools Foundation.